You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Rory Bradley, and it's entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, 13 Lectures. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on February 7th, 1915. In the previous lectures, we considered what might be called the problem of death, and we have connected that with several painful experiences of the recent past. The first thing I would like to do today is draw your attention to a few more general things connected with the problem of death, as well as a few things that can be investigated with the tools that initiation knowledge provides us with. We absolutely must understand that when human beings pass through the gate of death, they enter a world that is entirely different from the one we usually think of. It is a completely understandable tendency of human nature to imagine that the realm that lies on the far side of death, the spiritual realm that we enter through the gate of death, is similar to the realm of the senses and reason that we occupy between birth and death. I say that it is also an understandable tendency to imagine this realm as a sort of continuation of the one we currently occupy. But this is a mistake. It is difficult to find words within the treasure chest of our language that make it even a little bit possible to sufficiently describe what is experienced between death and a new birth. I have often mentioned that our language is well equipped for the physical world, and that we must, in a sense, develop a deeper and more inward-looking relationship to these words if we hope to make them capable of expressing what lies on the far side of death. The way in which these words are to emerge from the soul when we are describing something that lies on the far side of death must also be entirely different from the way in which words emerge from the soul into the sensory world, into the world of reason. This way of speaking about the spiritual world and its beings and events is much more an act of giving oneself over to the spiritual world, an act of allowing the words to be conferred upon you by that realm. The kinds of words that I spoke yesterday in relation to our dear friend Frau Grosseins were not formed in the same way that one might form words when expressing something about the external physical world. Rather, they were poured into our souls by the being of which they spoke, in such a way that this being actually gave those words, poured them forth, leaving us not with the feeling that these words had expressed and objectified something that we then beheld. Instead, we were left with the feeling that something is being expressed through us, that we are simply the expressive organs that allows something to be objectified in a spiritual expression. It is, therefore, an entirely different process, a process of giving oneself over to this being, so that it might find an opportunity, through the mechanisms of our being, to express its own nature and its own inner experiences. It is not a matter of adapting to something external, but rather a matter of giving over to the being in question, a matter of placing our words at the disposal of that being so that it might then use our words to express itself. All of this is to say that here we are dealing with an entirely different way of relating to objectivity than the way practiced here in the world of the senses and of reason. This is why a certain flexibility of the inner life, a certain ability to align with various individualities, an enduring ability to step outside of oneself and give oneself over to another individuality, are all among the most basic prerequisites for establishing a proper relationship with the spiritual world. If you hope to really and consistently hit the mark, if I may use that phrase, when expressing things about the supra-sensory world and about what lies and about what lives in those who have passed through the gate of death, you must above all else be cured of what could be called earthly egomania. One must be filled with the ability to think not only of oneself, to not be at the center of attention. If you have a strong tendency to talk a lot about yourself or to think a lot about yourself, you must overcome this tendency, because talking and thinking a lot about yourself is really the worst way to get to self-knowledge. If you have a tendency to talk a lot about yourself or to judge everything in such a way that you consider yourself, your position in the world and your significance to be more important than everything else, if you have these tendencies, then you are ill-equipped to find your way into the spiritual world or say anything about the spiritual world. In the spiritual sense, we engage with ourselves the most when we engage with ourselves least and think about ourselves least in the earthly sense. The thing that is most interesting to us in the earthly sense, the connection between the world and our own person, is the most insignificant and meaningless thing for the spiritual world. Thus we will always find that the path into true spiritual reality becomes the most difficult for us when we feel continually compelled at every opportunity to speak about ourselves, about what should happen to us, about what our potential value might be to the world, and so on. When we live our day-to-day lives in this way, then even in that daily life, which is also ruled by spiritual forces and impulses, we find that things are not right. All sorts of notable connections can be found here. I have come to know people who constantly complain that they find it incredibly difficult to get up in the morning. People who say they find it difficult to resolve to pick themselves up. I have even come to know people who have readily admitted that if there were not an external reason compelling them to get up in the morning, they never would. You can always find an inner connection between a person's way of being in the world and such a tendency as this. Generally, there will always be people who tell you a lot about themselves, about what they like and do not like, the good fortune or misfortune they have encountered, and so on. Those of us who want to prepare for a truly objective grasp of the spiritual world must pay attention to these things. For we must observe and consider life if we want to enter into reality. And of this you can be certain. We as people are always naturally disinclined to obey the directive to take life objectively. We have no greater inclination than to take ourselves completely seriously and consider external life with minimal seriousness. Only gradually do we struggle to arrive at the words that can become good, true leitmotifs for life. In the case of great geniuses, we often observe how much they undertake, only then to express all of their life's wisdom in a single word. When they express such a word, it takes on a completely different meaning than the one it has in the course of daily life as spoken by someone else. I pointed this out once before. It was during the lectures held in Norrköping. How easily you can say the great and penetrating phrase from the Apostle John, quote, children, love one another, close quote. But it means something entirely different when some fool, some oaf, running around in the world says it, and not John, who said it at the end of a rich life, during which he lived through many, many things on the earth. When it comes to words, it is not simply a matter of what is correct or proper, but also a matter of the soul foundations that underlie it, of the depths from which it springs. Goethe also strove throughout a rich life to arrive at a beautiful phrase, whose depths ought also to be fathomed. But you cannot plumb these depths simply by believing, in reference to this phrase, that it can be understood by anyone who has lived long enough. Arriving at an understanding of it by this means, it is far too simple. And this may sound paradoxical. Any child is actually capable of this sort of understanding. But the way in which it must be understood, when you understand it, as Goethe did, on the basis of an incredibly rich set of life experiences, is beyond the understanding of any child. I am speaking about the phrases, quote, you yourself live with the world in peace, close quote. The connectedness of these two sentences, and this is the heart of the matter, shows us that there is no self-knowledge that does not lead to a life led in peaceful communion with the world. I would like to discuss all of these things in as much detail as I can, because they are far more important than you might at first believe. But I can really only point them out to you, and then leave them to you to meditate upon. In any case, I would like to point them out to you, since many people have been saying that there is a lack of good material to meditate upon. There really is no lack of good material, if you simply have the goodwill to allow life to provide you with the material for meditation that emerges from life itself. Now, once we, as human beings, have stepped through the gate of death, we are immediately brought out of all of the Maya-like conditions in which we have been living, the conditions in which we have been ensconced for as long as we were living in a physical body. We are brought out of those conditions because they have been imposed upon us by the very fact of our incarnation in a physical body. Above all, we are taken away from a great many routines and activities that we had come to enjoy during the life between birth and death. Those are things that we can no longer do after death, of course, because we lack a physical body. Life itself becomes entirely different, as does our relationship to the world. And if you meditate on the Vienna lecture cycle titled The Inner Nature of Man and Our Life Between Death and Rebirth, you will gain a picture of the way in which we have to relate to the world if we want to form true concepts and ideas about the life between death and a new birth. You need only try to live into the words, to inwardly enact the words that were expressed in a stammering and halting fashion there. With such things, this is always an urgent necessity. During the past few days, I have already drawn your attention to the fact that the moment of death can only be superficially compared to the moment of birth into physical human life. For on a day-to-day basis, if unsupported by clairvoyant knowledge, we do not remember back to the moment of our birth into the physical body. The capacities given to us by the earth do not allow us to remember how, let alone that, we were even born at all. If there are people today who believe that they know everything there is to know with nothing more than their senses, they are forgetting that their senses cannot even offer them an experience of the moment that began their earthly life. We know that we were born only because others tell us that we were, or we know on the basis of a syllogism that is often not even conscious, but rather one that we formulate unaware. If we do not seek the aid of clairvoyance, these are the only two methods by which we can convince ourselves that we were in fact born. You can have someone else tell you that you were born, or formulate a syllogism that goes like this: other human beings were born, I am like those other human beings, therefore I must have been born at some point. A true and proper syllogism. There is no other method available to the capacities we receive from the earth. We must either be told about it, or we must formulate this syllogism. So our effort to seek enlightenment about our birth already begins to enlighten us about the fact that it is not possible to find a real foundation for truth in the senses alone. The moment of death is thereby unlike the moment of birth, insofar as we can always, in the spiritual world, look upon the moment of death, whereas the normal faculties of the physical body do not allow us to look upon the moment of birth. In the spiritual world, during the time between death and a new birth, we can always look upon the moment of death, once we have successfully brought it to consciousness for the first time. There it is, but not in the same way that we see it here as an experience of fear. It stands, rather, as a wonderfully magnificent life experience. The soul, spirit, human beings exit from its physical sensory shell. The liberation of the will and feeling impulses from the thought being that had been flooded with objects. Let me read that part of that sentence again. The liberation of the will and feeling impulses from the thought being that had been flooded with objects. The fact that after death, the human being is not immediately able to glimpse this moment of death is not because we have too little consciousness once we have died, but rather the opposite. We have too much consciousness. Just remember what was said in the Vienna lecture cycle. We do not move into a life of too little wisdom, but rather into too much wisdom, into a seemingly unending and all-encompassing flood of wisdom. It is impossible to be unwise after death. This wisdom comes to us like a light that washes over us from all sides, and we actually must learn to curtail it, to gain orientation in an environment in which we have at first no orientation. And so by attenuating the high level of consciousness to a level of awareness that we can bear, following upon the earthly preparation that we had before death, by attenuating it to this level, we arrive at what might be called the moment of awakening after death. Immediately after death, we awaken too much, and we must tone down this overwhelming state of being awake, must dampen it to the point that is appropriate to the capacities that we developed through the experiences we have had in various earthly incarnations. It is a struggle to master ourselves in this overwhelming state of all-encompassing consciousness. And then comes something from which all of us must recover, both those who have passed into death and also those who intend to properly enter a process of initiation, must recover, in a sense, from the things that we have grown used to in our physical sensory lives. In order to make this understandable, I would like to connect it with another experience. When we began our spiritual scientific movement with a very small circle of people in Berlin, we were joined by all sorts of people. We were a very small group back then. One day, not long after we had begun our work, an individual came forward and declared that she needed to step away from the work. The reason she gave was that we were not on the right path. According to her, it was not important to be seeking all the different things that we were seeking. The only thing that should be sought is unity. This was a sort of idée fixe for the person in question. In a long conversation, she elaborated on this idée fixe of unity, and then she left us to go and seek it. This person believed that by seeking unity, she would enter into the suprasensory world. But this idea of unity is actually nothing more than the final abstraction of external physical life. This quest for unity is actually the most sensory thing that the human being can look for. We must be cured of this drive for unity if we hope to find a proper place in the spiritual world. Here, in the sense world, it is such an obvious thing to say that we must strive for universal unity. We must look for the unity within multiplicity and diversity. But this is really significant only for the sensory physical world. Then we step through the gate of death, and we are no longer within a world of multiplicity and diversity, but rather within something that comes before us as an overwhelming and all-encompassing consciousness. Once we have stepped through the gate of death, we have nothing more or less than unity all around us. There it is a matter of finding multiplicity and diversity. There our only quest must be to emerge from unity and move into multiplicity and differentiation. Now, I would like to give a truly fitting imagination of how you move out of unity and into multiplicity. Just imagine for a moment that we step through the gate of death and into this world of overflowing spiritual wisdom. This is the world that we first move into, a world that is initially confusing when we awaken in it. Let us imagine this world in such a way that we can see an overflowing light surrounding us, a unity that completely fills this world. This is how it first appears to us. We cannot even separate ourselves from this all-encompassing light. The unity is so strong that we cannot differentiate ourselves from it. We have no sense of separation between ourselves and this world. Instead, we are completely integrated into it. Everything is part of a single unity. But now let us think about the answer to a question. I would ask you to think for a long time, and not just a moment, about the answer. Now let us answer this one question. What is it actually, this unity into which we have been integrated? Think about all of the beings of the upper hierarchies. You know about 9 of them, or 10 if you include the human being. In every level of the hierarchies there are a great number of beings. All of them have thoughts. It is not just the human being who thinks, but rather all of the beings of these upper hierarchies as well. So just think about the huge number of beings that we join when we step through the gate of death. They are all around us. When we step through the gate of death, we are integrated into the whole collection of spiritual beings. We do not perceive them at first, but we are among them. What first surrounds us is the sense of unity. But what is this unity made of? It is made up of the thoughts which drift in and through and around one another of all the beings of the hierarchies. This thought world of the hierarchies is composed of the undifferentiated thoughts of all the different hierarchies, with no distinction drawn between what one being thinks as contrasted with another. All of that blurs together into one unity. We grow and extend into these thoughts of the hierarchies. This is the overflowing being of light and thought that surrounds us. This is the unity. We come to live in the thoughts of the hierarchies, blurred into one another to form a unity. This is what we come to live in. And so what must we do in this life after death? What is important is that we establish a relation to the individual beings, that we rise up out of the ocean of thoughts, wherein all of the thoughts of the hierarchies blur together, and establish relationships with the individual beings in their multiplicity. After death, we do not need to establish a relationship with the unity of overflowing thoughts from the hierarchies, because that is already given to us. Rather, we must work through this unity until we can establish a relationship to the individual beings of the hierarchies. How do we do this? At first, this blurred ocean of thoughts from the hierarchies washes over us. Because of the things we have acquired during the time spent in our physical body, our inner being, rising up out of its sensory casing, remains at the gate of death, which we look back toward. This being gives us strength of will. Will impulses oriented toward feelings. Feeling impulses oriented toward the will. We become inwardly aware of these impulses as we behold the being that rises up from the physical body, the being that we are after death. This allows us to radiate beams of will outward, so to speak. And now, when we radiate these beams of will, which are created out of the energy of death, born in the moment of death, when we radiate them outward into our surroundings, we extinguish something at a particular point in the spiritual world. And when we direct our will elsewhere, we extinguish something at a different point. And the same is true of a third point or a fourth. In short, at various points in the spiritual world, we extinguish the overflowing world of thoughts through the application of the force of our will impulses. And by extinguishing this thought world at that point, the being of the hierarchy who lives within the spiritual world steps into the frame around this hole in the thought ocean of the hierarchies. In the physical world, we must try to find thoughts to apply to the things that we see. But in the spiritual world, because the thoughts are constantly surrounding us, we actually have to extinguish the thought, to push it away. Then the being steps before us. We must become the master of these thoughts, and then the being approaches us. And the power to become master over the thoughts, the power to push them out of our field of vision so that the being can step before us, within the ocean of overflowing thoughts, we obtain this power by beholding the moment of dying. The moment of death marks the magnificent moment of inception for our spiritual life after death, and also serves as teacher in the extinguishing. After death, death itself becomes the teacher in this necessary act of extinguishing. It stimulates those forces of will that we must use to extinguish thoughts and generate spaces of the overflowing ocean of light. This is meant to serve as an indication of the different ways in which human beings are related to their surroundings before and after death. In the sense world, we stand there and are surrounded by a circle of air, and then must wait until something enters into the circle. After death, we are instead surrounded by a circle of light and thoughts, and we must extinguish a thought that lies within our field of vision in order to then see the corresponding being that stands behind it. For in this we must deal with beings in the way that I described in my book titled The Threshold of the Spiritual World. This is how we move from unity into multiplicity, into differentiation. Monism, in the sense that most mean it, is a philosophy suited only to the earth, and it is nothing more than a chain once you have stepped through the gate of death. In that moment, the necessity of monadism arises, the need to seek multiplicity and differentiation. Seeking unity is the last chain of sensory rational life. What is it, then, that we actually undertake there? It is an action that creates a space wherein the hierarchies can approach us. We are creating a space for ourselves. Our being is then spread out across the entire world. We have pointed these things out many times before. We create a space for ourselves so that objective things can appear to us after death within the frame of the space we create. Something objective can never appear to us in the spiritual world, if we carry our own being into the spiritual world. We can recognize the other in the spiritual world only when we create a space for the other's appearance by extinguishing our own being from that spot. And this occurs in the manner I have just described. This also serves as an inner description of the process needed to connect with the dead in the way that I described at the end of yesterday's lecture. When the need arises to create an opportunity for the dead to speak for and express themselves, you must attempt to push yourself, your own thoughts and feelings, away from the spot where the dead person is, so that impulses can step forward from the depths of being that place words in your mouth without your will. These are words that must come when you hope to allow the objective being of a person who is no longer physically incarnated to express herself. You see that the faculties, which are by and large the weakest part of the human being here in the physical world, the will and feeling impulses, these are indeed the weakest and most unclear parts of the human soul in the physical world, the faculties of which we have the least mastery are actually of particular significance when it comes to perceiving things in the spiritual world. On the other hand, the faculty that is strongest here in the physical world, the imagination, indeed we love to live in our illusions and fantasies because we have the greatest mastery there, is the thing that is weakest in the spiritual world. We cannot do much with illusions in the spiritual world. They simply obscure the overflowing unity of the thought world. What matters is not the development of our imaginative life, but rather the development of our will and feelings. And this is the essence of meditation. In meditation, it is not a matter of what we fantasize. What is important, and I have stressed this often, is that we imagine with great inner strength. It is a matter of inner energy, of strength, of will. All of this includes a will element, which we must develop in meditation, and which we develop even more strongly when we do the work, the spiritual work, that we are supposed to do through and during meditation. The single most harmful thing to making any progress into the spiritual world is the addiction to dreaming, to forming illusions about external reality, because this makes the will weaker and weaker. You weaken your will the most when you cultivate the parasites of imaginative life, when you generate illusions about all sorts of external things. You will never move down the path to the spiritual world by distancing yourself from life. Rather, you must become clear about the things you encounter in life. You will never move down the path to the spiritual world by distancing yourself from life. Rather, you must become clear about the things you encounter in life. It is not through the impoverishment of external life, but rather its enrichment, that we move into the spiritual world. People will be able to grow into the spiritual world through strength, not weakness. When the external world and the life of the external world are of no interest, this is weakness. It is weakness when we cannot live up to Goethe's maxim, "Know yourself, live with the world in peace." Before I move into further considerations of death, I would like to draw attention to the fact that all human artistic activity must have as its basis the soul activity, S-O-U-L, that will prove necessary to us after death. For the purpose of artistic activity, the will element, not the visual element, must be filled by the spiritual world. In this time of artistic decline, particularly the decline of artistic work, the opposite is proving to be true. In this time of a similarly declining understanding of the world, the moment that imaginative life makes more refined is being carved out. This is why artists of our time are ever more dependent on models and standards. They can hardly do anything without a model or a pattern. This is also why artists are becoming more and more isolated within their art. But being isolated in one's own art can never lead to true art. This is the opposite of what should be happening. What happens, for example, when someone depicts a human being through art, either in painting or sculpture, and has no concern for the inner forces that form this person, no concern for the dynamic element? What happens when the artist simply approaches the person as a model only, as something simply to look at? What happens is that the artist distances him or herself from the actual principle of artistic creation. The beginning of creation happens when one creates a form of voluntary inner seeing, when one does not simply look at something from within, but rather penetrates into it and perceives the forces that shape the brow, push out the nose, and so on. This constitutes true artistic creation. And the same is especially true when it comes to nature. In that case, it is particularly important to live into the activity of the natural world. And here I would like to draw your attention to something that we experience shortly after passing through the gate of death, but that remains relatively unknown to us here in the physical world. When we paint, we are chiefly painting the things that pass over the surface of the object we are painting. We paint light and shadow. We paint color. Now, external nature is filled with light and color because it does not integrate them into itself, but rather casts them away. The object is there, and it throws light and color back at us. Minerals, for example, are minerals precisely because they do not integrate light and color into their inner being, but repel them externally. The human soul, however, actually lives within these colors. After death, the soul moves immediately into that realm. It recognizes itself in the light and color. but here in the physical world, the soul does not recognize itself within them. When the landscape painters step before a natural landscape, they must have some part of what exists between themselves and the landscape. They must be able to wrap themselves up in it. They must, in a sense, bring something into the physical world that is actually realized only after a person has passed through the gate of death. This is what makes artistic creation similar to the act of standing in the spiritual world, even if the act of living into and being integrated into the spiritual world remains largely unconscious for the artist. And even if the need for something to be awakened through this connection with the spiritual realms, spiritual remains unconscious. This is why the construction of our building has been done in the way that we have done it. So that, as I have often mentioned, people are called upon to attend to what is not there, rather than to what is there. I would like to say that even the spaces that have been carved out should be attended to, rather than just the pieces that were left in place. In this sense, a beginning for what must be done in our current cultural stream has been made through this practical embodiment of our spiritual scientific stream. You see, the kinds of projections of the spiritual world into the human world, through what I have called the spectrum of death, which we saw in the artistic works I presented yesterday and the day before, were more typical in a time not long ago. Now it is less typical, and our natural endowment toward it will continue to fade, making it even less typical. But the less that people here in the physical world can establish relationships with the spiritual multiplicity, the more bound up they will be when they move through the gate of death. The possibility of creating empty spaces will be lost if people continue to move out of relationship to the spiritual world. But that is what absolutely must happen according to the external progression of world events. The old clairvoyance must gradually fade. If we cannot reestablish that relationship to the spiritual world through spiritual scientific development, then people will lose the ability to live in the spiritual world after death. They will lose the ability to be true and full beings. Instead, they will be chained and bound up, as though in a prison, by the one thing that is always left to them, by the ability to look back on life, where beholding the moment of death should actually be something very significant and defining for the human being. When those who have been strengthened, if I may put it thus, by spiritual scientific development, move through the gate of death, they relatively quickly achieve freedom and the ability to act freely in the spiritual world. Just think about how necessary the immense sense of connection with spiritual scientific impulses is for a being to live immediately after death, as was shown in the case observed in the words spoken by Frau Grossheinz's soul. What we see is that the human being receives, through spiritual scientific development, a replacement for what had previously been given as a natural faculty, a relationship to the supra-sensory and to spiritual phenomena. When you are able to see something like the spectrum of death through a natural faculty, and people in earlier times always saw these spectra of death, we simply do not know about this now, because it is a capacity that has been lost. Then you see this spectrum of death through an act of separation from your physical body. This enables you to see the particular individual forms of the phenomenon. This separates these particular phenomena out from the unified whole. And this is the important part. This act of separating something from the unity teaches you to perform that action. but the opportunity to learn how to separate something from the unity was completely lost with the fading of atavistic clairvoyance, and it has to be replaced through a growth into spiritual science. This spiritual scientific strengthening will also be the thing that will bring about the necessary capacities for artistic creation in the future. Sculptors, musicians, painters, and poets will be unable to create if they are not filled with what spiritual scientific strengthening can give them. In our time, people are still afraid of this. You can hear their fear when a sculptor, musician, painter, or poet comes forward and says, quote, "Ah, spiritual science, that involves a lot of work and effort, and it will kill my original primal artistic abilities," close quote. You can hear this sort of thing everywhere, but it is merely an expression of the fear of the power that is necessary if art is really to remain viable for humanity in the future. People are afraid of the incredibly strong power that must step forward from within. A time will come in human development when artistic capacities must be ripened through spiritual scientific strengthening. In any case, that would prevent the sort of nonsense that we are seeing now. People suddenly, and with no basis whatsoever, declare themselves artists at the youngest possible age, and then actually believe themselves to be artists. Then, when their status as an artist does not lead to anything, they believe that the world simply does not recognize them. This nonsense will gradually cease. The art of the future will be an art of maturity, and only at a relatively late age will people feel the inner maturity that can lead to artistic activity. People will no longer believe that at a later age in life one lacks the energy, the youthful energy, as people often say, needed to create art. People will actually find, rather, that through deepening and spiritual scientific strengthening, the energies that lead to artistic production in the future are first released from the inner being. But right now, people are still afraid of these energies, just as they are afraid of anything that must be gained through struggle. This is why many artists have an unholy fear of pulling things up from the depths of their inner being. And when they hear that it is not the external, earthly individual, but rather the higher individual within themselves that should be creating art, they fall into a state of utter confusion. You can hardly imagine a more complete state of confusion than the one into which current artists fall when they realize that it is the genius within the inner being of a person, a genius that belongs to the spiritual world, which actually creates art. One contemporary artist expressed the unholy fear that he had of this spiritual world in the following words, quote, "Genius is a terrible sickness. Every author carries a monster within his heart that consumes all of his feelings the moment they are born. Who shall win the battle? Shall sickness conquer the man, or the man conquer the sickness? One must be a truly great man to hold his character and his genius in balance. If the poet is not a giant, if he does not have the strength of a Hercules, then he must sacrifice either his heart or his gift." Close quote. It gives you goosebumps of the soul when you hear such things said aloud. For what we are hearing is nothing less than the unholy fear of the part of us that is connected with the spiritual world. And it is a very consequential thing to say, even if the author is not aware of how consequential it truly is. For the fact that he speaks of giants and of Hercules is incredibly telling. It is telling that precisely these words came into his mouth or into his pen, as the case may be. This might even lead to the perspective that human beings must win the battle by what they are in earthly life, for that meaning lies within these words. A true understanding of the matter would show us that the genius within a human being, the healthy genius, fills and takes hold of that person, making him into its instrument. Another contemporary artist adds some very peculiar words to the sentences that I have just read to you. Very peculiar words indeed. He says, quote, "Let us bring to mind the tragic downfall of Laocoon, as described in the Aeneid. The citizens of Troy watched with horror and repulsion as the enormous serpent choked Laocoon and his sons. The witnesses felt fear and sympathy, and they likely also felt a desire to rescue the unfortunate men. However different the conditions of their souls might be, the will experience for all of them played a very important role. But then, in the midst of this agitated and horrified crowd, let us imagine an artist who considers the catastrophe playing out before his eyes as the possible theme for a powerful work of art. Amidst the general excitation of the screaming, frantic, praying crowd, he remains the calm observer. In that moment, all moral instincts within him are suppressed by aesthetic curiosity." Close quote. And this is supposedly a necessary condition for artistic creation. We supposedly have people who are not artists standing there feeling the deepest of sympathy, and they cannot help. And then we have this oaf, this dullard, who has no inkling of the pain produced by the situation, and this dullard is supposedly the real artist, the one who can depict this moment, who stands there like a fool, just so he can observe the whole thing. This is what we have come to at present, that someone can confidently proclaim that a dullard, a complete fool about the phenomena of life, is in fact the true artist, because he is capable of being, in quotes, objective. He should banish sympathy and compassion from his heart and become an unfeeling oaf, and only then, according to these words, can he depict something that will fill others with interest. You cannot be more fully grasped by the most abhorrent Ahrimanic forces than to find yourself in a position where you can put forward such a perspective on art. This is the decadence of our time, created by the fear and anxiety generated by facing spiritual reality. Not to know that if you hope to be an artist, you must be able to experience the events of the world with deeper sympathy. You must actually have a deeper sense of sympathy, as well as the capacity to look at these experiences more objectively at a later time, with this same sense of deep sympathy, in such a way that you are able to love them the way you might love an unknown being. You then arrive out of this even deeper feeling of sympathy at an artistic creation. We have come so far in the perversity of our worldview that the opposite of the truth is spouted as though it were the sum of all wisdom. And I am convinced that there are countless individuals who consider this idiocy brilliant, and who think that this praise of artistic dullness is the ultimate discovery of what art truly is. So we find ourselves here in the present, and we must seek the fulcrum of spiritual scientific strengthening that will give us the ability to know ourselves in the world that we will enter during the natural progress of events when we step through the gate of death. And thus, art can appear to us as akin to death, which is to say, as akin to the higher life. To be akin to death is to be akin to higher life. In many ways, to step into the spiritual world, we must acquire an ability to arrive at other imaginations, other ideas than the ones that must fill us in order to understand the world that we occupy between birth and death. We must be sure not to break through the Maya into just another instance of the Maya, while believing that we have actually broken through to the spiritual world. The Maya is thicker in certain areas of life than others. When we consider various areas and aspects of life, we find that the thickness of the Maya varies. It is woven out of many different things. Although it is all part of the Maya, it is woven out of different things in various areas of life. When we approach a child, we learn to recognize it in its physical existence. We develop imaginations about the child that are composed of the experiences that we have formed after approaching the child as a being within its physical body. If we hope to truly recognize this being when it has stepped through the gate of death, we could make no greater mistake than to carry such an imagination and nothing else into the spiritual world. Recently, we went through an especially poignant karmic experience in relation to Theophis. We would have a completely false picture of him if we were simply to perpetuate the imaginations that we formed of the child according to how he came toward us in the physical world, and then to project those imaginations up into the spiritual world. In such a being as this one, we can sometimes find a great maturation and ripening shortly after death. We can find the energies that the child brought into the world through birth, which were not fully realized in the physical world because karma did not permit it. We can find these energies interwoven with cosmic forces, and we can gradually perceive how a mature soul that brought itself into cosmic existence through death grows upward toward existence within the spheres. And when such a soul was still a child in its last incarnation, then we can perceive how relatively quickly it grows in order to channel its forces into those of the cosmos. This is when we come to know the person after death, as he channels with his own being the forces that are part of his spectrum of death and interweaves them into the forces of the cosmos. This is how the human being grows into the creative process that one might call, quote, heavenly creation, close quote. Then his willed feeling and his felt will impulses coalesce with the world outside. Just as we gradually grow to adapt our sensory organs to the external physical world as a child, the way we grow into sight, for example, so too do we grow together with being itself after death. We grow together with the unfolding of the will. And if we allow such phenomena to work upon us in a truly spiritual scientific sense, we will gradually notice how the Maya of external life is woven together at varying thicknesses at different points. It is difficult to penetrate at certain points, such as at the death of a very young child, because most of the aspects that were a part of the external appearance obscure the things that must step into that space in order for us to have a proper imagination of what that individual is after death. But then there are also people for whom it is relatively easy to penetrate through the web of Maya, because the truth of their being was also able to penetrate deeply into the Maya that lives here in the physical world between birth and death. There are also people like this, people who have brought beautiful treasures of inner spiritual wealth down into the physical world through their birth, and who are in the position to weave what they have brought down from the spiritual world into who they are. These are the human beings whom, because of what the Creator has made of them through love, we also must love infinitely. These are people about whom we often do not ask why we love, because it simply seems self-evident. Such beings are like living witnesses of the spiritual world, because they already strongly resemble their spiritual being here in the physical world, and because the veil of Maya can be easily parted through love, so that one can truly see into the depths of their soul. A certain tenderness is owed to such people, a certain desire to be near to them, because they have brought a great gift down from the spiritual world into their physical existence. After death, they exist as though they were living witnesses for the deeply significant fact that the impulses of the spiritual world live on in all things revealed to us here in this world. If we gaze upon such people after death, they stand before us as though to say, quote, "This is how we once were, and the fact that it is the deepest, deepest, most inner truth that we were once this way is proven by the fact that we have passed through the gate of death," close quote. They stand there, even after death, like apostles of faith. Like apostles of faith who help us to see spirit everywhere in the life spent here in the physical world. So it is with our dear friend Sybil Kalatsa, who recently passed away. She stood like an apostle for the belief that the world in which we live is filled with spirit. And so we must then explain why in her case a particular thing happened. In the sight of her spiritual being, we also had to verify what the shroud of her external life stood for in the physical world, for those who knew and loved her. This is why there is a different sort of tone in the words that had to be spoken from out of her soul, because of this particular individuality about whom I said, quote, "And your voice ensouled this being, your voice, which bespoke more through the kind of words than through words themselves, revealed what was hidden within your beautiful soul," close quote. Notice that the description transitions from the past tense, from the imperfect to the present tense, because the beholding of the life in the body has flowed together with the beholding of the life after death. This is expressed in the words. This is the necessary course of the words that must be formed from out of the spiritual world. This is what must be said, quote, "It ensouled this being, your voice, which bespoke more through the kind of words than through that which the words revealed, that which, hidden, is present in your soul," close quote. Quote, "is present, not was present," close quote. It is ongoing, still there. Quote, "Yet your devoted love unveiled itself completely to empathic humans without words. This being of noble, quiet beauty heralded the sensitive awareness of the creation of worlds and souls," close quote. Now, let us consider a soul like that of our dear friend Fritz Mitscher, who died so young to our great sorrow. He was a soul that, for those who knew him, lived in such a way that we might say something of him, meaning it in the most beautiful sense, that some might consider cold and dry, but that nevertheless really expresses the essence of that being. He was an objective man. Fritz Mitscher was a totally objective man. The moments when Fritz Mitscher talked about himself were few and far between. And when he did talk about himself, he was really only seeming to talk about himself. Actually, he was really describing his relationship to someone or something else. His I was almost never the center of his considerations. I cannot say that he ever made himself the center of attention. And it was typical of this man that when he was called upon to talk about himself, as happens naturally sometimes when an older man speaks with a younger man, giving him advice about life and then naturally tuning the conversation to the younger man himself. In those instances, he would evade you and turn the conversation towards something he was experiencing in his surroundings, in order to describe it with the art that he was already able to use, having gained it through spiritual science. He was therefore an objective man, a man of objectivity. He did not think about his significance to the world. He did not think about how his I fit into the world at large. He had practical interests in the most eminent sense, practical interests that could be expressed most characteristically when one is not always so concerned with how they fit into the world at large. Fritz Mitscher belonged among those people who at an early age develop a certain zeal for expressing deep truths to you in passing conversation with the utmost objectivity. He belonged among those who always approach this with the same zeal because they are interested in the matter at hand and not in their own person or in the place of their own individualities in the world. And if he spoke in front of an auditorium full of people, then it would be the purest, most innocent realization of the matter at hand, and never the experience of watching someone lose himself in the sole impurity of talking about himself. This was something so characteristic of him. And this also enabled him in the most eminent fashion to take up the world in such a way that he really entered into the world through the medium of the idea, the thought, and the imagination, rather than being taken out of the world by them. He always lived into things more deeply, into the connections of the world through his thoughts, ideas, and imaginations. This was how he lived together with the world. This was how he lived with his I, precisely because he spoke so little about it, in the midst of things, and not merely in his skin. Such people are really the only ones who understand what ideals in the world are, what life is in ideals and ideas. Life in ideas and ideals does not mean simply that you have ideas and ideals. You can have them, of course, for they are as easy to pick as blackberries. But it is not just about having ideas and ideals. Rather, it is a matter of having ideas and ideals in all of their richness of thought. And just about every person runs away from that. People run from thinking in droves. Oh, my dear friends, you need only call up the imagination, the genuine imagination, of true and pure thinking before your soul, the imagination of the life of pure thoughts, a life spent in thoughts and ideas, freed from the sensory realm. You need only to erect this innocent source of soul existence in your imagination, and then try to place the spectra of other people around it. And you will find that people flee in droves from this innocent source of thoughts, freed from the sensory world. Quote, oh, it is sober and dry, it rips love out of the heart, it is cold and frigid. Close quote. That is what they say, and they flee. They flee in droves, and only a very few remain behind in that place of soul innocence. These are the true philosopher souls. These are the people who are truly meant for philosophy. Among them belongs the sort of soul that Fritz Mitscher was. In people with such a nature as this, it comes about as something practically self-evident that they grow into the conditions of their life in the most natural manner possible. Or, to put it better, they allow themselves to be carried into the conditions of their lives by karma. This was absolutely the case with Fritz Mitscher. You never saw him take up a place somewhere because of an intention on his part, which is to say, because of an intention connected with his physical body. He always allowed himself to be carried by karma to the tasks that befell him. This is the proper nature of a philosopher, who must be led to his tasks, and who does not push himself into one task or another out of some sort of egotistical will. Such true philosophers know all too well, in both their feelings and their impulses, that one is never actually prepared to undertake a task. One can really believe that one is ready to undertake a task only when one is extraordinarily vain. One actually is always anticipating something that one will only later master. Only when you have this sort of understanding do you get a sense in your life of what your inner calling truly is. And only then will life be full, to a certain extent, with the demand to know yourself. You learn to know yourself best when you think and speak as little as possible about your I. Then the things you affect and the work you do for life will be full, with the call to know yourself, live with the world in peace. This was Fritz Mitscher's motto. Such a life continues as it was into the spiritual world, remaining just as it was here, except that the seed becomes a fruit in the spiritual world. We must avoid asking the unreal question, quote, what would have become of such a being if he could have remained for a longer period of time in the physical world? Close quote. This is not a consideration based in reality. The real consideration leads us to the great and wonderful fact that such a soul is integrated into the spiritual world, and that what it is now called to carry out in the spiritual is related to what it experienced here between birth and death, in much the same way that a fruit of a plant is related to its seed. In other words, our present life is really a kind of seed life for the spiritual life after death. When it comes to a soul with such a nature that lives so fully in objectivity, we must, when considering it after death, sink into the soul the words that will describe both this objective conception of life and also its relationship to the surrounding world, standing fully within the world with the other parts that are, with the other beings that are part of the world. We must sink these words into the soul. This is how I needed to speak about Fritz Mitscher, and this comparison between the seed here and the plant that develops more fully over there can be placed before the soul as a characteristic description of him. This is how I explain why the words became what they were. Quote, as a loss that pains us bitterly, thus you vanished from the field, where the earth seed of spirit in the blossom of soul being ripened to your sensory sphere. As a hope that cheers us, thus you stepped upon the field, where the spirit blossoms of the earth through the force of soul being might reveal themselves to research. A being of pure love of truth was your striving's steadfast aim. Creating from the light of spirit was your life's earnest goal, toward which you strove untiringly. As a hope that cheered us, thus you stepped upon the field where the spirit blossoms of the earth, through the force of soul being, might reveal themselves to research. Hear our soul's plea. sent after you in confidence? We have need for earthly work of powerful forces from the land of spirit, for which we have our dead friends to thank. A hope that cheers us, a loss that pains us bitterly. Let us hope that you, far yet near, not lost, illuminate our lives as a soul star in the realm of spirit. Close quote. And so Fritz Mitscher is one individual about whom we can say these things, which are also real and true in regard to many of our dead friends who have passed into the spiritual world. On the field of spiritual life that is ours to tend, they are our most active co-workers. They become the ones to whom we look with special thanks when we think on the tasks of our present and future spiritual development. Tasks that can only be completed slowly and with great difficulty by the forces that we have through our physical incarnation alone. So it seems to me that we should ask of our friends who have passed through the gate of death, as well as our friend Christian Morgenstern, to remain by us as though they were posts to be occupied all over the place. Much can be accomplished in our spiritual movement with the help of their forces, which could not be done with earthly forces alone. This must be the last earthly message sent to such individuals, and it must be clearly spoken to our dear friend Fritz Mitscher in particular, who will be a strong ally for us in the manner I have just described. Because of his youthful energy, he will be a true comfort, a comfort where comfort is needed. It is needed often. The hard work and striving that we have done recently has brought so much before us. We have seen how great are the barriers on the physical plane, barriers that we had not imagined. How severe are others' judgments toward the things that we are doing, and how contrary they often are in expressing their opposition. We need only to think of something like the following example. What I'm about to say is not said for any personal reason, because I really feel that I am only a weak instrument for the spiritual movement that carries us all. People out there, outside of our spiritual scientific stream, are writing brochures, brochure after brochure, about how our members simply take up everything on the basis of loyalty and belief and trust, without confirming it themselves. People are claiming, in a sense, that there is nothing but blind faith within our circle. This is how people out there describe our movement, as though everyone who is a part of it is a blindly faithful dullard who follows along because of a sense of trust. That is what is said out there. Within our walls, the sense of trust does not look nearly so shiny and spotless. Meaning the sense of trust that exists in the deeper parts of the soul, and not the trust placed merely in the words, in the surface layer. There is, in fact, a great disparity between what people are complaining about in their brochures and what is actually present here within our walls. What I am about to say, I say without any critique or bitterness, and I do not mean to be directed at any one person. But if someone with an eye, EYE, towards some of the things that I said here during the fall had had occasion to write about Dr. Steiner, is just wasting his time with certain concerns, by which I mean the subjects that I was speaking about, that he is wasting his occult powers with these concerns, if someone could just have written that, it would have been a clear indication that the sense of trust that people out there say is the only thing that is keeping us together, even if it is the case that there is trust in the superficial levels of consciousness as a Maya, it would be proven that that sense of trust is not nearly as strong on the deeper soul level. In the end, the teachings presented here are not grounded in any authority and are not meant to be taken as dogma. I say this while also wanting to point out that every detail of what I say has been checked. But to do something like declare myself the judge of the full extent of my esoteric research amounts to spiritual tyranny, which absolutely does not arise from what must, of course, be present to some extent, not for the sake of spiritual science, but for the sake, I would suggest, of the community. The spiritual tyranny arises from a subconscious lack of trust. Taking up a set of teachings does not require trust, but if you do not simply take what the spiritual researcher presents of the spiritual world as a codified standard, and instead expect practitioners of spiritual science to discover for themselves the tasks that lie before them and the things that fall within their area of research, this takes a kind of trust that can never be disadvantageous to our movement, because it does not move into the realm of interpersonal relationships, and it does not interfere with the teachings. But such a fact, like many similar facts, also indicates that there are still many great barriers and difficulties present for us. And it means that within our spiritual movement, we must continue to perform the duties that arise from our insights into inner necessity, even if those look to be distant from what we might desire to accomplish. These duties will always be carried out, even if they make us sour, according to our usual understanding of the word sour. But in the moment that we see that we may give our dear deceased friends a kind of personal assignment to remain with us and to participate in our work with their energies, we immediately feel a sense of security within our movement that the physical world can never give us. And so by thinking of our dear departed friend, something flows into the impulses of our movement that is supra-sensory, something that comes not just out of the things that we can experience sometimes as inspiration in the physical world. What arises is, in a sense, possibility. Into the maya of our community's work, something supra-sensory flows into the impulses and makes us feel certain. When we do something, it is completed not only on the physical plane, but also concretely in the supra-sensory realm that has remained with us, not in its physical being, but through the presence of our dear departed friends. This allows us to be certain of the effects of our work, which will be felt in the streams of spiritual becoming. Quote, "Hear our soul's plea, sent after you in confidence. We have need for earthly work of powerful forces from the land of spirit, for which we have our dead friends to thank." Close quote. And so it is that we speak about our departed friends as our compatriots, our co-workers, our comrades, as beings who remain unseen beside us. In this way, we can concretely grasp the invisible being, extend our hand one last time in the physical world to our friends, and grasp theirs in the supra-sensory world after death. And in this exchange of handshakes, we see a symbol for the work of a community that should speak not only for the physical world, but whose work should also call out and echo into the suprasensory world. We are trying to build a place for this sort of work here on this hill. Let there be a place here for such work. The end of Lecture 7.